From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thank you for joining us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. This week, we opened with the ongoing debate over civility and whether it's appropriate for restaurants to refuse to serve members of the Trump administration. That's what happened at a farm-to-table restaurant in Virginia, which politely declined to welcome Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Well, we welcomed two local owners of establishments, Harry Bronson, who's a state assemblyman and the co-owner of Equal Grounds Coffee House in Rochester. You'll hear him first, then Kevin McCann, owner of McCann's Meats in the South Wedge.
How far do we go with civility? I mean, are we just talking about words here? What happens if I know someone is a gay basher? Do I welcome that person into Equal Grounds? I probably am not going to. But here it is a difference of political beliefs and a difference of approach and governance. I get that there's a lot of hate out of this administration, but I'd rather try to work through that versus excluding them.
So if there's a gay basher, if anyone who has been among the more prominent gay bashers, and there have been plenty in our public lives over the last couple of decades, came into Equal Grounds, would you potentially view that as an opportunity to start maybe changing their mind? Because a lot of people who bash gay people haven't hung out and spent time with a lot of gay people, and all of a sudden they've got a gay child and everything changes.
Yeah, right.
You know, so would you view that as an opportunity?
It depends on, you know, how we're defining gay bashing. I mean, okay. If it's hate language, I might try to work through that. If it's physical safety issues,
absolutely.
I would not welcome that person.
Yeah, I think that's well said. So Kevin, does Gopnik's argument move you at all, where he says, you know, we should all assume that, of course, you can come to my table as long as I can come to yours, and what he's perceiving in this administration is an exclusion from their table, which would justify a decision from a business owner?
To me, it's an extension of what you're seeing in political conversations across the board, which is just a complete unwillingness to listen to an opposing argument. You know, it's I'm right, you're wrong, that's the end of the story. And nobody wins with that. We make no progress with that. So my philosophy is always listen. And so to just exclude in that fashion is me not following my own belief, right? So I might not agree with your politics. I might not agree with the positions that you're taking, but I still have to be willing to engage in the process, in the conversation. So in some ways, there's a lot of logic to the argument. It's just not the approach that I would take. I mean, vegans and vegetarians are in my butcher shop all the time, and we welcome them, and we have things that they can eat.
I look at, for example, someone like Damon Linker, who writes for The Week. He's a centrist writer. He is not comfortable with the Red Hens decision. He's not comfortable with exclusion. He wants to see anybody who disagrees willing to be open to others and try to work to change minds. And people have been sort of bombarding his mentions by saying, okay, let's say you own the Red Hen. David Duke comes in. You're going to serve David Duke? You're going to serve someone who's a white supremacist, Richard Spencer? You're going to do that? And there are times when I think, I don't know if that question is fair, but I think it kind of is fair. I think we should ask as far as it goes as a thought experiment. So David Duke comes in, Richard Spencer comes in, you're going to serve them.
I was actually having this conversation with my staff just this morning as we were talking about me coming here. And I was saying, you know, I wouldn't really exclude any specific demographic. And they said, okay, well, what about not demographic, but someone walks in that is a convicted child molester? That's something to consider, right? Actions that have been proved that are deplorable, that it's not a question of thought process, it's a question of actual taken actions, then yes, I would ask that person.
So there are lines you draw.
Sure.
Someone's wearing a swastika on their armband, as an armband when they walk in.
You know, the kids these days are wearing all kinds of stupid, they're out there looking for responses like that. So while I don't believe in what the swastika stands for, who knows what it means to that person? I find it personally deplorable, but
would you engage in a conversation all while serving them?
That's also a situation where in public, maybe I would, but I don't necessarily know as a business owner, it's my job to have a discussion of morals with a customer who came in.
But what if you've got a customer who says, hey man, I'm just trying to sit here and that guy's wearing a swastika and it's making me uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's, you know, hopefully I don't have to deal with this scenario. But in that case, if it's making that customer uncomfortable, then everybody deserves to be comfortable, and it's a conversation that I would take.
All right, so it's case by case, though.
Yeah.
Next, a discussion with gun owners who are progressives. Pew Research finds that only 16% of Democrats own firearms, but that still accounts for thousands of Americans, and they want to be part of the debate over gun policy.
In this clip, you'll hear three progressive gun owners discuss what they think their fellow progressives tend to get wrong about gun ownership. The panel consists of Alexis Thorne, Walt Borowick, and Dave Tessie.
One of the hardest things to get around in a conversation if you're liberal versus conservative is the fear. I think a lot of people are scared of guns. They don't understand what they are. They just know that, oh, this is meant to kill someone or something. And they take that fear and they run with it. And they say, I don't want to have another conversation. This is scary. People die. You know, accidents happen. We want to just get rid of this. And I think that fear-based culture surrounding firearms is really, it dampers even having a conversation between liberals, conservatives, independents, and it stinks, quite frankly. I recently had a conversation with someone who was quite a bit more liberal than myself about gun ownership, and that's the one wall we kept running into was that, you know, people die. It's a fear-based problem. And
are you worried that it could affect your friendships or relationships?
It hasn't so far. Most of my friends are like me are quite liberal, and I've got nothing but support from them so far. I think that speaks to our relationship. I think meeting new people, however, and letting them know off the bat, you know, I want them to be aware I'm a gun owner. I have a gun in my house. This is not something that's negotiable. And I think meeting new friends and new people, that can certainly be something that they're like, we don't want to associate with that.
What about you, Dave?
I think that the problem with the progressives and what they tend to get wrong is just that I think they lack empathy with the more rural America. I think that there are many in rural communities that associate guns and gun ownership with their cultural worldview. So when we demonize the guns themselves, we're really threatening that worldview. And so I think that causes some gun owners to alienate themselves from the party, even if they agree with a lot of the other social aspects of the party itself.
I think that's important. Guns, according to Pew Research, can be essential to identity. Roughly 3/4 of Americans who currently own a gun say they can't see themselves ever not owning one, and that many will say that that's sort of part of how they view their own identity.
Absolutely.
Walt, you were nodding, Walt, when he mentioned rural America and some associations there.
Born and raised in Buffalo, a city boy, but in the last part of my life, actually for about 30 years, I've lived in the country or on the edge of the rural. I know those people. A lot of them, as I said, are hunters. A few of them are NRA members, and it's crucial. I think you put it well. It's part of their worldview. It's part of their culture. And as you said, they're never going to give it up. So if we want to go in the direction of, say, Australia, take all guns away, or most of them, not going to work in the United States.
Next, we had the chance to sit down with a German diplomat, the Consul General of Germany in New York State. His name is David Gill. He was visiting Rochester, and he took the time to discuss trade, the Trump administration, and international relations.
Gill grew up under communism, and he was critical of President Trump on several grounds. But when it comes to comparisons to Nazi Germany, he told us this.
I grew up in East Germany, in a communist country, and I know how it is to live in a country which doesn't have a free society, doesn't have free speech, no democracy, etc. And that's why I'm really worried that we take it granted that democracy and free society is given in our countries. No, we have to stand up and we have to stand together. And that's why I want to work on this transatlantic relationship here as a consul general with many, many Germans and Americans who are also convinced that this relationship is very special and it should take on as a very special, special relationship.
You, Consul General Gill, above most guests that we will have on this program, are probably fit to answer a question like this. In our politics in this country, there's something that we call Godwin's Law. And Godwin's a gentleman who created this idea that the first person to, well, he said essentially, whenever there's a heated political argument, eventually someone is going to invoke Hitler. Someone is going to say, you know, such and such is like Hitler, or make the comparison. And the idea being that the first person in an argument over politics who invokes Hitler has lost, because that's the extreme, that is silly, that not everything is so extreme. And yet, with this administration, We saw him leave Singapore, and he said recently he likes seeing how the North Korean people will salute their leader and immediately stand up and cheer him, and he wants more of that here. And the alarm bells go off for people when he talks about the press and attacking the press. Mm. And some people invoke Nazi Germany and Hitler. Mm. And you grew up in East Germany. Are those comparisons not productive and not helpful? Or do you think there is a place for at least asking if we are on similar paths?
I won't draw these parallels.
You won't
definitely,
draw the
parallels? Definitely not. And,
okay.
And you have to recognize this country has a stable democracy over decades, over centuries almost. And not almost, over centuries. And Nazi Germany rose after 10 years of a very unstable democracy. At least we had democracy in Germany in the 20s of the last century, but it was a very weak democracy. It was a very weak government and very weak institutions. And I would say I believe in the institutions, democratic institutions, in the institutions who were taking care of the rule of law, etc. And that's why I'm not so worried. We are in another century, in another situation than we were 100 years ago in Germany or after the war in the communist countries in Eastern Europe. Nevertheless, I'm puzzled by some remarks the president does. Yes.
Well, speaking of Nazi Germany, we're going to close the week with a conversation with a Holocaust survivor. The Rochester Jewish Film Festival kicks off next week, and one film tells the story of a local Holocaust survivor. Jack Feldman grew up in Poland and was sent to Auschwitz during the war. In the camp, he was known only by his number, A17606.
The tattoo on his arm caught the attention of his great-grandson, Elliot. Elliot interviews Jack in the film, and it's called The Number on Great-Grandpa's Arm. We sat down with Jack, Elliot, and Jack's granddaughter, Elliot's mom, Stacy. In this clip, you'll hear them tell Jack's story. We'll start with Jack talking about life as a teenager.
Well, I went to school. I didn't finish school because the Germans came in. They took me to the camp.
Stacy is his granddaughter, who can add a little bit to that. Do you want to add to that?
So when my grandfather was about 14 years old, he was told that he could no longer go to school, and his family had to leave their home and move into the ghetto into a one room with 15 other people. And while he was living in the ghetto, he was taken from the streets and he was put into a locked basement. And from there, he was sent to several labor and concentration camps. Ultimately, the last camp he was in was Auschwitz. And in Auschwitz, he has some interesting stories because the reason he believes he survived Auschwitz is when he arrived in Auschwitz, Mengele, who was the Nazi doctor who would decide whether you went to the gas or whether you went to work, pointed to my grandfather to go to the gas. And my grandfather's father owned a hat company, and the man right beneath him at the hat company happened to be a capo in Auschwitz, which was one of the Jewish prisoners who had a higher position in the camp, and he saw my grandfather in the line for the gas and pulled him out and put him in the line for work. And in addition to that, he made sure that my grandfather was assigned an extra job. During the days, my grandfather would have to go and dig holes and do whatever jobs the Nazis were requiring them to do, but after that, he would then have to clean his, he had this extra job where he would have to clean a Nazi officer's apartment or room. And he believes that that's the job that helped him survive because while he cleaned this Nazi officer's room, he would eat the scraps of food that were in there. So ultimately, Nazi officers knew that the Russians were approaching the camp, and so they decided to send them all on a death march. So he was sent out, I believe it was around January 17th, and they marched from Auschwitz, ultimately ending around May 5th in Germany, where he was liberated on the side of the road, first by the Russian.
By the Russian.
And then
the American came in.
And after that, he went back to his hometown to see if his parents or his siblings had survived. Unfortunately, they had not, but his father was one of eight, and the other seven siblings and their children lived in a nearby town where he would spend his summer. So he went to that town where he found two first cousins and a woman who ended up later being his wife.
Jack, when you think about the fact that you could have been in line for the gas, as
yes,
they say.
Yeah.
Were you thinking in those days, this is it for me?
Didn't care. I know sooner or later I wind up in the gas coma. You know, I was used to it already.
Did you have fear?
No fear.
I think it's because he was put in the position that he was going to die so many times throughout so many different camps that a lot of them had no fear and they just wanted to get all the pain and suffering over. But obviously they were relieved when they were freed because they realized they would never have to.
So Jack, I want to ask you if a story is true. It's the story that you ran Jack's Fish Market on Joseph Avenue for decades.
Yeah.
And when people would come into your store when they were hungry, you knew what hunger was because of what you, and so you would feed them for free.
Right.
Yes?
They never went out hungry. They always get food, drinking.
Tell me about the French fries.
Fish and fries.
He told all the children who were hungry, if they went to school during the day, they could come into his store afterwards and he would give them fish and French fries.
Right. Fish. After school, there was waiting.
There was a line?
A line waiting for fries and fish.
I love that story.
Yeah, it was very nice.
And that's empathy right there, man. Jack is providing a service in this community because he knew what hunger was like. During the Holocaust, trying to survive, walking on the road. And that's just an amazing part of the fabric of this community. Our listeners might remember in a few years back, we commemorated the 1964, they're known as the riots in Rochester, and a lot of shops were broken and burned. Not yours.
Not mine.
His was...
All my helpers. I got all those helpers. They stayed in front by the window.
They linked arms in front of your shop.
And they didn't, nobody broke in, nobody broke the window. I was the only one.
Elliot, what do you know about that story?
I know that he was, so there were a lot of riots on his street, and all his African-American workers, they stood chained in arms, and they were saying how good of a man he was, how he would get everyone free food, he would give them free drinks. He wouldn't make them pay if they couldn't, and so he was a very helpful man, and he helped everyone out, and so he was the only store untouched on the street.
What did that mean to you, Jack? Was that an emotional thing for you, that your store was protected?
Yeah, well, I was, how do you call it? Emotional.
You were emotional about it.
Yeah. It's like... Everyone says if you're nice, it's going to pay off in the future. And it really did for him. His store was untouched. All his property was saved. And so, yeah.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. We will talk to you Monday.